Investors Chronicle.
Companies and Markets Show, welcome back. Today we've got reactions to Rishi Sunak's spring statement. We've got coverage of Warren Buffett's latest takeover. And we chat to Mary McDougall about her feature, Can Tech Save Healthcare? All that and more, let's get going. Welcome back to the Companies and Markets Show. It is Thursday afternoon for us, not for you listener, it'll be Friday or maybe even the weekend. Joining me in the studio, Mary McDougall, hello.
Hello.
Welcome back. And then over the line, we've got our regulars, Mark Robinson. Hello, Mark.
Hello, John. It's like a time machine, isn't it, really, this programme?
It is. Julian as well, hello.
Oh, hello there, John. Hello, everyone.
Hello.
Yeah, we don't actually leave the studio between recordings.
You enjoying the weather in Devon?
Oh, it's very beautiful, as always. Thank you.
As always. And Alex Newman.
Hi, John.
Hi. Hiya. And the weather's okay in Norfolk?
Yes, it is very nice as well. Yeah, I think the whole of the UK is basking in it today.
It's been great.
No squalls then.
Yeah, so we're all crammed into various studios around the country.
We're not international, but national.
An extreme form of social distancing.
Well, quick news roundup before we get into it properly. Things first, spring budget. Chancellor Rishi Sunak's spring budget has been met with widespread criticism for not going far enough, or in fact anywhere, to tackle the cost of living crisis. Headlines were a £6 billion national insurance cut for affecting 30 million workers and a one-year 5p cut in fuel duty. A rising energy bill cost would be reassessed in autumn, Sunak said, with annual inflation predicted to rise to nearly 9% in Q4. Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway has wandered back into M&A market for the first time since 2018 to purchase the insurer Allegheny. We've got a breakdown of this deal to come a little later. More sanctions news. The list of UK sanctions to Russian companies and individuals has expanded to include the world's largest diamond miners. That's Alrosa. Some of the companies reports we've covered in the magazine this week include Cineworld, Marshalls, PensionBee, YouGov, Restaurant Group, Deliveroo, Kingfisher, Oxford Nanopore, and Dignity. They're all online. They're all in the magazine this week. And finally, quick look at markets for the week. FTSE 100 pretty flat this week, up around 1%. Wall Street likewise very steady. Apple doing some heavy lifting for tech stocks. That's up around 7%. Right. That's enough from me. I'd like some of your guys' reactions to the spring statement. Mark, maybe we can come to you first.
Well, what's fairly clear, I think, is that he had little in the way of wiggle room coming into the budget. The public finances have been in their worst shape in peacetime. Certainly to be expected given what's gone on in the last couple of years. And now that it's obviously being exacerbated by the security situation in Ukraine, it's not surprising that it's a fairly modest set of proposals in the budget. I guess he said by the end of this parliament, there'll be a 1p cut in the basic rate of taxation, which will be welcomed by everyone, but I'm afraid all this really means is that our spending power is going to keep on reducing through the end of this year and probably beyond.
Yeah, I think it's even worse than that, isn't it? Like they're talking about, the Resolution Foundation is talking about an £1,100 fall in the average working household's budget for next year, which, yeah, I'm sure we can all look forward to that. But it's interesting, isn't it, that the Resolution Foundation is now taking the role of the old Institute for Fiscal Studies. So as soon as the budget comes out, they spend the whole night taking it to bits and then rubbishing it the next day, which is really what they're continuing in that fine tradition. But I mean, it is, we are looking at some of the worst squeeze in decades, isn't it? Sometimes since the 1950s, it was as bad as this, the mid-1950s, I think they were talking about it. But I mean, it's just a combination of everything at once, isn't it? Ukraine, you know, we're all paying more now for wheat because a third of the wheat comes out of Ukraine and Russia. And then on top of everything else, you had the supply squeeze anyway after the end of the pandemic. So it's, you know, it's the worst possible set of scenarios in which to be the chancellor, isn't it, really?
Yeah, I mean, on that point about Russia, Ukraine as well, they're two of the largest wheat exporters in the world, but also two of the largest suppliers of fertilizer. And of course, you know, if their gas production falls, then it puts further pressure on the production of nitrate fertilizers. So it's hard to see how food prices will come back down to earth for a while longer, I would imagine. It's obviously spells a lot of trouble for household budgets. The outlook for investors is mixed, to say the least. I mean, I guess people aren't exactly running for the exit yet, but I think what it will probably do is accelerate that rotation into value stocks going forward.
I thought, Chris Stillo highlighted this in his take on it, on the budget yesterday. But two of the interesting things I thought from, you know, which obviously didn't really get the headlines because, you know, the cost of living is the main focus. But the OBR's reaction is, you know, they still seem quite optimistic about the UK economy. So they think real GDP is going to grow 3.8% this year. And that's a big drop from what they were expecting in the autumn. But it's above trend. And I think one of the things they are expecting, I mean, they can sometimes be a little bit too bullish, the OBR, when it comes to business confidence. But if listeners recall back to, I think it was last year, there was some of the tax breaks that were announced to encourage business investment. I mean, some of them were enormous. They're almost, you know, they're sort of, one of them I think was 130% tax rebate, so almost being paid to make some capital investments. That is gonna really boost business investment by, like, you know, 11% or something this year. So there is that. And then the other thing is that, you know, although they, OBR said that although consumer spending is going to take a bit of a hit this year, they're also expecting consumer spending to rise by 5.4% after inflation. And that's, I know last year was, you know, it's a slightly awkward comparison because we're still, you know, coming out of serious lockdowns, but that's the sixth largest rise since the Second World War. So it's quite a funny picture. I mean, I consumer stocks, maybe that's not the worst news, you know, if you're sort of cutting through those pretty deservedly gloomy headlines. I don't know.
It depends on people's ability to pass on the costs, isn't it? Which is, yeah, so far they've been able to do, isn't it? So that's why a lot of share prices in kind of consumer durables have held up, isn't it? Because they can more or less defend their margins when inflation rises. But then that sort of runs out, doesn't it, down the road?
Well, there's other issues as well. I looked at Next results today. And one of the points there, if you look behind the figures, is the level of discounting. Their profitability has held up well because, compared to past years, they haven't been in a position where they've been able to discount. I mean, their inventory levels were historically low levels because of the pandemic, and there was obviously outage in terms of their high street stores. But the point, the main point that I took away from it anyway, was the fact that there has been reduced discounting, and the more discounting you get, the more that affects the bottom line. Now, going forward with discretionary incomes shrinking, that may no longer be the case. So the high street retailers might struggle in terms of profitability, I think.
I was just going to say, it does feel like a weird world that we're living in, where the OBR is forecasting growth of over 3% and at the same time forecasting that living standards are going to drop by the most since 1950.
We still had rationing in 1950 as well.
It was the good old. It was always better in the good old days, wasn't it, Marcus?
Oh, yes. Where you were then.
Let's move on to our second item of the day. French geriatric Warren Buffet is back in the M&A space, as I mentioned a little earlier on. Julian, you wrote very briefly about this earlier in the week. What do you think the appeal of the insurer Allegheny was to Buffett?
Yeah, thanks, John. It's an interesting deal he's done. It's the first big M&A he's done in 6 years, which is quite a long time for Berkshire Hathaway to be out of the market. But they spent 12 billion of their 146 billion cash pile buying it. I mean, essentially, the appeal is that it's an insurer. I think there's no two ways about it. Buffett owns quite a big chunk of the American insurance market. So he's Berkshire is about the second largest line insurer for motor insurance, for example. And Allegheny has relatively sort of niche positions in that. And they also do reinsurance, which seems to be another thing that he favors. But the reason I found it quite interesting was that insurance seems to have been the basis on which Buffett built his business. I think that's, I don't think there can be any doubt about it. And he said himself that the first insurer he bought in 1970, it was the foundation for Berkshire Hathaway. And I kind of dug into it a bit and I was trying to work out why that would be. And I mean, insurers are profitable, but you know, they can go through long years of fallow years, particularly if they've got a lot of claims or there are disasters or something, and all that profit can be wiped out quite quickly. But what I hadn't realized, and there doesn't seem to be an equivalent in the European market, is that in America, for example, insurers, between the time that you pay and settle a claim, there's a sort of time gap. Sort of, sometimes it's up to 60 days. And you pay this money gets paid, and the insurer can then invest it on behalf of its own shareholders. So you get this. The reason he likes them so much is that they essentially generate free cash that he can use for his investments. So there's a constant stream of cash flow that comes into Berkshire Hathaway on the basis that the insurers take time to settle claims. And this cash pile sort of runs through the company's accounts, which I don't know. Alex is probably a bit more knowledgeable on this point, but I don't think you can do that here, can you? I don't think you can redirect short-term money through the parent group, can you, from an insurer? I think it's almost ring-fenced here, but isn't it, by comparison?
Yeah, and whether or not you can, I'm not 100% sure about that, but I know that the insurers in the European market, whether it be a product of Solvency II rules or just long-running rules, is they invest in really boring stuff. They invest in, you know, fixed income and you know, dependable bonds. I mean, they may stray out into corporate bond territory, but I mean, Warren Buffett loves equities. That's his. You know, that's his kind of modus operandi, and he you know, puts cash where he sees value, and yeah, I mean that is like you said, that has been the driver of the Berkshire Hathaway empire. It is underpinned, you know, and it's sort of funded the growth of everything else that's you know from Apple to Kraft to everything in between. So yeah, I mean, it's just an insight he had 50, 60 years ago, and he's kind of run with it. So,
well, it's actually skimming, isn't it? I mean, it's skimming the business, isn't it, in a funny sort of way. But the thing I found interesting about the other interesting about Allegheny is it's not just an insurer. It's got these weird ancillary businesses. So he's, along with the insurance business, it has another company called Wilbert that sells funeral and cemetery accoutrements. There's various bits and pieces for cemeteries, and there's another division that's a children's toy manufacturer called Jazzware, and sort of weird, but also precision cutting instrument. I mean, he hasn't just bought one bit, but it comes with all this other stuff. So you kind of wonder, whether part of the attraction was that he will be able to break up this rather funny sort of business and sell off the other sort of divisions for more money than they, you know, it looks to be worth on paper. So I think that in many ways it's a typical Buffett deal. It's quite sort of astute on the one hand and a little bit eccentric, but ultimately I can't see them losing any money on it, I would have thought.
I think there are some parallels between the two companies as well, because Berkshire Hathaway, prior to him joining, prior to him turning it really into a large general insurer, is that it was Berkshire Hathaway was a manufacturing company to begin with.
They used to make drapery or something.
Yeah, textiles, and then it. Yeah. I think what it was, it came to his attention because he noticed what was happening to its share price whenever they'd sell off a mill. He almost like Simon Thompson in that regard. You know, he's seen a pattern there and acted upon it. But, you know, over the years, it had various arms as well. You wouldn't say it was necessarily a conglomerate as such, but it was a relatively old company, and so it had sort of a few bolt-ons there which have been shed down through the years. And maybe he's, like, as you say, maybe he's thinking he can go down that road again.
Well, I mean, it must be entirely possible. I don't know what everyone else thinks. I've always been a slight Buffett skeptic. I often think that he gets the deals he does because he is Warren Buffett rather than effectively.
Yeah, of course. I mean, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy after a while as well. He gets to enter companies on such advantageous terms. There's limited downside compared to other shareholders in many cases. You know, he earns a lot of preferential stock, for instance, and very often there's sort of conditions attached to the ownership from Berkshire Hathaway's perspective. So, you know, it's the success has been self-perpetuating to a certain degree.
It's just all smoke and mirrors, isn't it? It's just a sham. It's a sham of a career.
A sham. Well, I know. Julian did use the term skinning before, which I normally associate with casinos and the mafia. So, I don't think it's quite that bad. I mean, you know, obviously he's been, he's a sort of a legendary figure, but it's not that he hasn't made mistakes in the past. It would be inconceivable if he hadn't, but I guess the last one I remember is that he took a bath during the early part of the pandemic by selling off all of Berkshire Hathaway's exposure to the airlines, and I think there was a loss of around about $5 billion. I might be wrong on that, but the strange thing about that is that he'd taken a bath on the airlines, you know, 20 years before or something, and had warned all the shareholders that you know, this is an area that you need to avoid. Oddly enough, Simon Thompson said that to me some time ago. So, you know, he's not perfect, but we'll see how this one pans out.
They're having a good year, Berkshire. They're, you know, it is their kind of inflation hedged qualities of that conglomerate has really shown its mettle in a tough start to the year. You know, the S&P, I think it's sort of come back a little bit in the last couple of weeks, but was certainly in correction territory. And they're having definitely one of their better years in a long while, having underperformed, you know, the tech, obviously the tech-led surge of the last decade. So, I mean, to take contrary view, I think maybe it's this sort of moment this year again after a few fallow years. But
well, I guess it's the rotation into value, isn't it?
Yeah.
That people have sort of noticed. And again, it's just one of those things where if he stuffs his portfolio full of inflation hedge companies, I mean, insurance companies are inflation hedged in many ways, and also for the amount of cash they produce. I mean, he's never really going to fail, is he, on that basis? Mm. But so another interesting deal, but we'll see how far what he does with it, really. And also their meeting is coming up, isn't it? I think that's the other point to mention, is that their famous sort of shareholder meeting is, I think it's at the end of the month.
Was it end of April, I think.
Oh, end of April. Okay. Yeah.
Just for the record, Allegheny's shares up 25% since the takeover.
Yeah, they got sold for $858 a share, I think. That was the premium.
So, yep.
Very good.
Very good. Thank you, Julian. Right. Finally, Mary has joined us this week because she's written a long read this week. Can Tech Save Healthcare is the title. Mary, what sparked your interest in this sector? Because it's not something you normally cover.
It is a little bit off my beat, but I just think it's such an important, interesting area. I wanted to jump into it. So we all know that healthcare services are really stretched. A tenth of the population were on NHS waiting lists at the end of December. Healthcare workers are overworked and exhausted. Lots of doctors want to leave. But more positively, technological advances are starting to converge and some people are really excited about the prospects for change. So I read a couple of books about this, and leaving aside the investment case, which we can talk about later, I think there are three key trends that are driving innovation, and it's how these are coming together that's what's exciting. So the first relates to scientists' understanding of molecular biology and genetics. So the human genome was first sequenced in 2003, cost $3 billion and took 13 years, and now it can be done very quickly for under $1,000. And most diseases have a genetic component, from cancer to heart disease. So being able to understand and read out and even edit genetics is going to make a big difference to diagnostics and early prevention. At the same time, people are becoming much more digitally connected. Just about everyone's wearing these devices, from Fitbits to Apple Watches and everything. And as sensor accuracy and portability is allowing more and more data on individuals to be stored. And then on top of that, you've got AI becoming much more powerful, being able to read out all this data and read meaningful patterns so that there's something that you can do with it. And advances in hardware and stuff is making this much more powerful. So there is hope that as these come together, they can actually really lead to big, meaningful changes in healthcare, but it's notoriously difficult to implement. And the difficulty for investors is the companies that are really at the forefront of this can be very prone to hype, often loss-making, and have a high probability of failure. So it's a really interesting area. There has been a huge sell-off in med tech and biotech stocks, which probably needed to happen. But at some point, the valuations will become attractive, I think, and it's definitely an interesting area.
Could you expand on the AI portion of it? I mean, how exactly does this does AI insert itself into healthcare?
Well, there's in lots of areas. So one area that people are very excited about is drug discovery. So at the moment, it takes 7 to 12 years to bring a drug to market, and costs over $1 billion, and the success rate is around 5%. And there are claims that AI can use some combination of paralyzed automated processes to guide the design process of new drug candidates, and in fact taking over and speeding up the job of scientists. You've got companies like Recursion, Tempus Labs, and Benevolent AI, which was involved in making a treatment for COVID. But so if these can work, that could have huge implications for the biopharma sector, but the technical challenges are huge and it's hard to predict how long it might take. There are some people that think it's sort of hype. Maybe in an area where AI is having more impact already is diagnostics. So you use AI to read scans. In lots of cases, they say that's more accurate than doctors can be, to help doctors. And maybe Renalytics is an example of a UK-listed company that's using a machine learning algorithm to check blood markers and compare them against medical histories to give you a kidney health risk score. That's an applied example.
I'm not quite sure I'd want to know about my renal health, to be honest.
I do think this area is generally really hard to invest in if you're not a medical expert. And there are quite a few funds that specialise on healthcare innovation and ETFs, which have had big sell-offs recently. But the managers, and I guess they're talking their own books, so they would say this, but the managers are quite bullish about the fact that the companies they own at least are well capitalized and won't require too much more funding, are actually in a strong position. I think biotech generally is now priced lower than it was before before the pandemic. So that means the market's sort of saying there haven't been any valuable scientific improvements in the last 2 years, which this is what one manager told me, which maybe doesn't make sense.
Great. Well, thanks, Mary. You can catch your full what, 2,500 words on healthcare tech in our magazine and on our website as per usual. Now we're not getting kicked out, so Alex, I'd like to come to you if that's okay. Just maybe quickly, we can touch on your FTSE 100 versus the UK property article. It sort of dives into the question of whether buy to let is the way to go versus the FTSE 100. What did you conclude on this?
I probably should admit that I don't fully conclude what the way to go is. But I mean, I suppose I took as my starting point the fact that property is seen, you know, we all need a place to live in, but also property, so many people talk about property as an investment, and it often is the largest asset on, you know, individuals' balance sheets. You know, with that in mind, I just wanted to compare the returns, quote unquote, from property over the last few years to the FTSE 100, which I suppose for, you know, UK investors is the most prominent and visible equity index. So, you know, at the same time, you know, we've had sort of the much heralded death of buy to let, and that's because, you know, been a raft of changes to the way, particularly the way that mortgage interest payments can be deducted, or tax can be deducted, and also stamp duty charges. So it you know, the returns that investors can expect from buying and then renting out a property probably diminished. But with all those caveats, I mean, the returns from the FTSE 100, on a, you know, which you should treat as a total return index, because it's dividend, you know, it's a big dividend paying index, and it kind of makes sense to think of reinvesting those, with, you know, reinvesting those distributions into the index for the long haul. On various measures, the FTSE 100 comes out ahead, and on others, UK house prices come out considerably ahead. Particularly if you've if you've rented it out and ridden the wave, really, of capital, you know, fairly low volatility capital gains over the last decade. And so, you know, the concluding thing I would say here is, I would be surprised if we see the same levels of house price inflation over the next decade, just because in certain pockets of the market, and we've talked about this a lot, it seems hard to connect prices to affordability. But at the same time, you know, there's nothing to be sniffed at the returns that you can make from you know, renting out a property. And really, I suppose investors have to look at property returns as a slightly lower risk bet than equities. The fact that they've come out ahead on some measures shows you that the you know, risk adjusted return profile is actually has been quite favorable for property, and it's not going to change wildly overnight, even though I think they're probably bumps ahead for the property market. So in a nutshell, you don't even have to read it now, that's the article. But that's kind of the sort of slightly awkward comparison I wanted to make, and just see if you can stack the two against one another.
Sorry, I threw you a bit of a hot potato there, asking you to conclude on something that you've actually just made a very nuanced argument for either way. But thanks.
Do you mind if I grab that hot potato just for a moment? I read something that was quite interesting recently, and if we make the assumption that a certain amount of liquidity is going to be withdrawn from the market, if the cost of credit goes up, if lenders become slightly more reluctant to lend under certain circumstances. We could see changes to median house prices then, because what I was looking at was the affordability index, and that looks at average house prices against median wages across several different economies, and the most expensive one by some distance was the Hong Kong market. Next in line was Australia, where the median house price was 11 times higher than the average salary, which is extraordinary, really, because, I mean, what used to be the standard multiple of 3 to 3.5 times your earnings, that's what you'd normally get a mortgage based on that. The UK is significantly below that as well. And in Australia at the moment, we're seeing a sustained fall in average house prices, and that's underway at the present time, and it's been on evidence for a few months now. Now, we may see something similar in the UK market, although, as I say, the multiples here are certainly more favourable than they are down under. But anyway, it's worth keeping in mind.
I think the two alternatives I'd add to that. One is, I don't know if you guys have seen in Hong Kong that these they're absolutely crazy. They're these kind of like bed apartment pods that in some residential building districts of Hong Kong, you essentially you're kind of, you work in the day, you come home to your bed pod. It's like those easy or those, you know, those Japanese business hotels. So we either go that route and Taylor Wimpey branches out into sort of bed pod accommodation, or we reconfigure the family unit into a sort of polyamorous multiple income generating unit, which can bring down those household income levels to something a bit more sustainable. So you never know what the property market will do to society.
Well, this is true. I mean, in Hong Kong, you can obviously see that the problem there is just one of space. I mean, you can only go vertical, really, in Hong Kong. It'd be almost like being a submariner, really, where you sort of share your bed with other sailors, which probably applies to the Royal Navy in general anyway. But
It's the lash and, rum and the lash, isn't it?
Yeah. You missed the middle one there, right?
Yeah, they're both going in the estate agent's brochure, aren't they?
Well, under that tagline,
rum, lash, and
John, we've gone off on a tangent here.
I know, this is where I need to rein you guys back in. I think we will have to end it there, guys. Just as we've gone over our studio allocation, although no one's come in, so I think we're doing okay. But thanks very much for joining, for calling in once again, guys, and thank you, Mary, for guesting this week. Thank you very much, listener. We'll catch you again next week, so we'll see you then. Thank you. The Companies and Markets Show was edited and produced by me, John Rogers, and don't forget, if you're enjoying our work here, head over to the iTunes store and drop us a rating and review. Thanks very much, and we'll see you next week. Bye bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.